I'll come to order. It's February 13th at 3:05 p.m. With us are Representative Berta Gardner, Representative Bob Book, and Representative Carl Gatto, myself, Chair Olson. First item on the agenda today is House Bill 289. It looks like it's going to be heard by Representative Seaton. And Katie, are you going to be helping? Why don't you pull up a chair? Are you doing it from the back row? We know who did all the work on this.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee. Appreciate you hearing House Bill 289 today. This came to the speaker and my attention because of the way that unemployment insurance is required and the exemptions that are allowed in law. Commercial fishermen, if they are paid solely by a percentage of the catch, under federal law and under state law, are exempt from unemployment insurance. They're not covered by the unemployment section. However, if they're paid by anything other than percentage of the catch, then they're employees. And so what has happened is there's the question of the commercial fishermen, crew members, when they are going through oil spill response drill training and exercises as to whether they are need to be covered under unemployment insurance. Unemployment insurance does have a lot of reporting requirements and all that are new if you have crew members that are strictly commercial fishermen that are paid on a percentage of the catch. So what HB 289 is doing is just adding commercial fishermen when they are undergoing training or less than seven continuous days of oil spill response training or response to that same category as if they were a commercial fisherman, so that they don't have to report as and pay and all the paperwork under unemployment insurance. The real reason for this is that we had the Oil Spill Prevention Act 1990 from federal legislation, and the state also has their oil spill contingency plans that are required. And one of the very key elements of that is the vessels of opportunity and commercial fishing vessels that are actually contracted with the oil spill response organizations to provide a lot of the basis for oil spill response in the event of a spill. However, there's all this training. Every year you have to have training, at least to maintain, every crew member has to maintain their, it's called a HAZWOPER card. It's a hazardous material operator card. And that, they get paid for that, but all of a sudden that becomes outside of a percentage of the catch, and that could throw one into this situation where you would have to do unemployment insurance reporting. And of course, if somebody's working or doing something 8 hours a year, they're never going to qualify for unemployment insurance. So this tries to strike the balance of saying that we are going to exempt commercial fishermen who are receiving a percentage of the catch when they are responding or on training for oil spills, as long as it's not over seven continuous days. If it gets over seven continuous days, then what you have is a situation where somebody, such as the Exxon Valdez spill, people should be in the unemployment insurance program. And I think everybody's pretty much agreed that 7 days will cover all the normal kind of training activities, but if there's a major spill, then those people would be covered because they would have to participate in the unemployment insurance program. And also, there's nothing in here that says that employers couldn't, let's say it's a 3 or a 4 day thing, if the employees and the employer wanted to be in the program, they could opt into the program at any time as well. We haven't had any testimony against this bill. Again, it's really to maintain the basis of oil spill response in Alaska and to allow that to go forward most efficiently. There had been a question raised about whether there was a problem with federal unemployment, and whether this would correspond, and you have in your packet a email back between the Department of Labor here in the state and the federal counterparts that says that this exemption will not cause any violation of the federal regulations. And so, Mr. Chairman, I believe that covers the main points of what this bill does. Again, the one thing we should remember, this isn't necessarily for fishermen, it's for maintaining an oil spill, an adequate oil spill response capability in Alaska. Because if you're only training one day a week or one day a year, and you have to go through all the paperwork and everything else, there were a number of people that said it's just not worth it anymore to have to try and do this and throw their crew members into an employee category instead of a 1099 and and not covered by unemployment insurance. And we do have some people available, Department of Labor, DEC program managers here, and also John Devins from the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. We have Captain Tom Colby of the Alaska Tanker Company, who is there to offer testimony or questions. They basically arrange for the tanker traffic in Prince William Sound. And also we have Tracy Mayhew of the Seafarers International Union. And thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Ledoux. And Representative Gatto, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often in a one-month period can a person work fewer than seven continuous days and still? And what I like about this, you don't pay in, but you don't get out either. It's not a, oh boy, I'm avoiding payments, but boy, when I need unemployment, I'm there first online. So that's the good part. The other part is gaming the system. Is it possible to say I got a whole month job, but if I only work days 1 through 6 and then days 8 through whatever, count numbers by 6, I won't be eligible to be required to pay. So with that in mind, you'd say that never occurs, or that's just a thought that I'm trying to interject into this scheme, and maybe some of the experts can answer, or maybe you know.
Well, through the chair, Representative Gatto, actually, as someone who in Cook Inlet has vessels that have been for years working in this situation, it's very difficult to maintain a crew. You have to maintain those. Every crew member for the training or for oil spill response has to go through the yearly training and maintain their HAZWOPER, their hazard material operator card, and so a vessel owner wouldn't be switching out in and out crew to avoid this problem. If you would have enough, if you'd have enough days where you're going to get 7 days, you want every day you can get. And so one thing I would like to point out, though, is this only covers commercial fishermen and not tendermen. I operate tenders, so the people that work for me don't get paid on a percentage of catch, so they're already employees. So this only exempts the people that are already exempt under the commercial fishermen statute. So tendermen, tugboat operators, all of those people that have employees, there's no exemption for them. And we maintain those kind of records, and it's not a undue burden on people that are in the business where they maintain those records. What's problematic is where you have a commercial fisherman that doesn't have employees. They're 1099, they're exempt, and then whether this particular training and this particular response would throw all of their crew members into an employee category. That's the only thing that this bill addresses.
Just to follow up, if an individual qualifies under the more than 6 day rule where they're required to pay in and then stop work and then start work, are they automatically in for the remainder of the calendar year, or is it each individual activity is treated separately?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, if somebody's there for more than 7 days, then they're in the program, and if you're doing the paperwork, you're doing the paperwork. I haven't looked at if there was another one-day training, whether they would be exempt or not. But you'd already be doing the paperwork on the person.
Representative Book, followed by Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton. You may or may not know this. I'm just curious, how many times a year do they try to do this training?
Through the chair, Representative Book, it depends on where you are. If you're in Cook Inlet, basically everyone has to take an eight-hour class, a one-day class, every year to maintain your certification. That's a personal certification. There's only about six or eight boats per year that receive any training. So maybe it's a dozen boats per year. The other 100 or so don't get training. So it's nothing that anybody really makes any money off of. You're trying to be there to be able to respond in case an oil spill comes up. In Prince William Sound, they have a different situation where they have a core group of vessels, and I think there's about 50 vessels in that that train for at least, I think it's a week every year. And then they have a second group that gets a little less training. And then they have what they're called vessels of opportunity, which are like in Cook Inlet, those commercial fishermen that have signed up and have agreed to maintain their crews as certified crews and ready to go. So there's several different layers, we might say, but in none of those are the training over seven continuous days for any of those. And you know, I have responded to several different spills that have been over 7 days myself. Up in Cook Inlet, we had one, and also the Exxon Valdez. So there have been but if you're into that situation where you're in a spill response of any duration, there's no ability under this bill to exempt people. They should be in the system, and they would be in the system in any kind of a long-term spill response.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think the two previous questions and mine really kind of get to the same concern, which is the language seven continuous days. And it just seems odd language, easily circumvented if somebody needed to, or suppose there were a storm that came up in the middle of the week's training and they had to discontinue and then go back out, and all of a sudden they're kind of working around this. And so I would like to ask the sponsor to consider, instead of seven continuous days, say they're exempt for the first 56 hours of training or 70 hours of training, so that they could be separated by days, but over time there would be enough time for them to get the training as intended, without worrying about which days it is and whether they're continuous.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, the purpose for the seven continuous days was for making sure that if we had a massive spill response, then people would be in the program. Our information is there is no training at all that goes over 7 days. In other words, people don't get that much time. They don't get paid that much. They don't get the companies don't hire people for 3 weeks out of the year, even if you're spacing it. You get maybe 3 or 4 days of training. The 7 days was really put in not specifically for the training, but if there was a short spill response, let's say you responded to a spill and it was 4 days long, it wouldn't throw that crew into the unemployment insurance because, again, it's a short duration. But if there was a spill that was people would be responding to for 3 or 4 weeks or a month, then they would be under the unemployment insurance program. And so the 7 days was meant, and all the people that we contacted said there's no time that they know of that there's anybody ever gets over 7 days for spills training.
Well, seeing no further questions from the committee, I think we've got four people online and two people question only. Rochelle, are you with us still? Cordova?
Yes, I'm here.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Rochelle Vandenbroek, and I'm the Executive Director of Cordova District.
Thank you for joining us today. Please continue.
I'm testifying on behalf of Cordova District Fishermen United in support of House Bill 289. We're a membership organization that represents over 1,000 commercial fishermen in Prince William Sound, and that includes approximately 150 vessel owners who participate in SURF's training. And these vessel owners, as you know, are trained in professional oil spill responders and are required to hire crew members at certain times of the year to participate in training activities. These crew members train for only a few days out of each year. On average, they earn less than $700 annually. When these SURF vessel owners received letters from the state of Alaska last year, many of these vessel owners came into our office threatening to leave the program. And this, of course, spurred action by CDFU and other organizations to lobby for a change in this legislation. The requirement for these vessel owners to pay unemployment tax is a costly and timely burden, especially considering the minimal amount of tax that is payable. As House Bill 289 recognizes, requiring vessel owners to process and pay quarterly Alaska's Department of Labor taxes for crew earnings would place a disproportionate burden on vessel owners. In the wake of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the state needs to ensure we have adequate vessel owners and crew trained and ready to handle another spill should it happen. We can't risk losing vessel owners over this issue, and House Bill 289 needs to pass to ensure our waterways are not vulnerable during the coming year and in the future.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Betty Shore, Anchorage, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Betty Shore. I am the Industry Preparedness Program Manager at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and the Spill Prevention and Response Division.
Please continue.
I am just here to answer questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. They had you down for testifying, but thanks. Any questions for Ms. Shore? Thanks again. Tracy Mayhem.
Mayhew,
I'm sorry.
I have been accused of mayhem at times. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tracy Mayhew, and I am the port representative for the Seafarers International Union. And the Seafarers International Union represents merchant mariners working aboard large ocean-going vessels. And in Alaska, this would be companies like Alaska Tanker Company, Seabulk, Tote, and Horizon. The SIU is in favor of passing this bill for a number of reasons. First, the contingency plan for oil spill response in Prince William Sound relies upon the participation of fishermen. Should the bill not pass and the fishermen pull out of participating in the oil spill response team, then the contingency plan could find itself in noncompliance. And if that happens, then this will threaten the livelihood of our members, the members that work aboard these vessels. Secondly, when you think about it, who better to protect Alaska waters than Alaskans? And you need the local fishermen involved in this, and you need them involved consistently. You want them there consistently in order to maintain a well-trained local response team. So another of our interests is in seeing that there are steady hands among the fishing crews who drill with our tanker crews. And it's this type of training and familiarity between the responder and the crew members that helps to ensure the best system of spill response and cleanup. Not passing the bill will create a disincentive for Alaska fishing crews to participate in this vital program, and as a result can also put other Alaskan livelihoods at risk. Again, I thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I can answer any questions.
Any questions for Ms. Mayhew? Thanks again, Tracy.
Thank you.
John Devins, are you questions only, or do you care to add anything?
Oh, I always want to add things. I have a few comments. I'll keep them short, though. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Devins. I'm Executive Director of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisor Council, which was formed after the Exxon Valdez oil spill to prevent any more such accidents and to make sure there's a better cleanup if one should occur. It's a cleanup part of our mission that I want to talk about today, and I'll be brief. Fishing vessels are an important part of the oil spill cleanup system that has been developed since 1989, and House Bill 289 is an important measure to ensure that Alaska's fishing vessel program continues to function as it should. Our group has been working on this issue since the Alaska Department of Labor raised it last summer by informing fishing vessel captains that they would have to begin paying unemployment tax on their crews when engaged in oil spill response training. These crew members are exempt from unemployment coverage during normal fishing activities. After consulting with fishing vessel captains, we became concerned that many of them might drop out of the program because of the paperwork that would be required for just a few days a year of training. To remedy this problem, we began looking for a legislative solution and have been happy to work with the sponsors of House Bill 289 right from the beginning. So all I want to say today is we support House Bill 289 because it fixes the problem by creating the necessary exemption for oil spill response training to keep the fishing vessel program in operation. We urge your committee to give your approval. And I have my own last comment. This is a good thing that everybody's in favor of, and hopefully you will pass this. It will make a lot of difference in terms of keeping a very good program alive.
Two things, we've been joined by Representative Newman, and Representative Book has a question for you, John.
Sure.
Good afternoon, sir. Thank you for joining us. I'm looking at a letter that was addressed to Commissioner Click Bishop, dated February 5th, 2008.
Mm-hmm.
In that letter, you ask a couple questions, and I was just trying to ascertain whether or not those questions were asked and answered. And you have some questions that are addressed to the federal agencies. I'm not seeing anything as a response in this package. Could you, as long as you are online, address that to the committee, please, regarding this bill?
Yeah, actually, at the time I signed that letter, we were under the assumption, the belief, that some things had to be handled at the federal level in terms of the Federal Department of Labor. And so we wrote a letter, or I wrote a letter, to the commissioner suggesting that some of this be worked out in cooperation or in conjunction with this bill. I have since sent a new letter which rescinds the old letter and essentially we've taken out the whole thing on the federal. I was mistaken at the time I wrote that. Right now I think you have a very good fix that should resolve the whole situation.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Devins. Is there anybody else online that would care to testify on this bill that hasn't signed up? With that, I'll bring it back into the committee room, and we have two people signed up question only, but is there anybody that would care to, in the room, that would care to add anything to this? Well, with that, I'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee.
I do have one question for somebody that's in the audience.
Oh, certainly.
I was wondering if I could, Mr. Chairman, ask a question of Paula Scavera.
Let's get Paula up here.
I needed to be roasted today.
Thought you were going to get off light, didn't you?
Yeah.
I did see a letter in here with your name on it, your signature is on this bill, and I was wondering if all the questions regarding the federal questions were answered to your satisfaction in here, and it looks like they are, but I would like it to be placed on the record so that when it comes up in another committee or whatever that, you know, we will have addressed this appropriately here.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm Special Assistant / Legislative Liaison for the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Through the Chair, Representative Book, in your packet is a bunch of emails, a connection of emails. It wasn't done in a fancy little memo, and it's from the U.S. Department of Labor. And it is to a Mr. Berkowitz, who was with the Transportation Institute in Seattle, Washington, who, not through us, but directly contacted the U.S. Department of Labor. The email is from the, and I got to get this right because there's so many acronyms, because the federal government loves acronyms. It is from a Robert Johnston, who is the supervisor of state conformity and compliance team, which means he's the guy who looks at all the state laws and regulations to make sure they're in compliance with federal law with the U.S. Department of Labor. And if I may read into the record, Representative Olson, I can read the couple lines that he is concerned about. Mr. Berkowitz, I have reviewed the draft legislation that you provided regarding the Alaska unemployment insurance coverage issue for fishermen participating in oil spill exercise drills response as drafted, which was the original bill. It does not appear to create any issues with federal unemployment compensation law, and as such will not endanger the certification of Alaska's unemployment compensation law under FUTA. And FUTA is the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. So I think that's the part that you were most concerned about. And yes, okay.
Any further questions for Paula? You got off light today. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
What are the wishes of the committee? Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, committee substitute House Bill 289. Version K with the tax fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is that moving it into a subcommittee for investigation or?
I
withdraw that comment.
Seeing opposition or no opposition, we're going to move it out of committee and take a brief of these while we sign off on it. Okay. 35, and with us we have House Joint Resolution 24, opposing federal insurance regulation, and I believe Karen's going to present it.
Yes, I am.
Karen, could you please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and you have our undivided attention.
Okay. It's good to be here. My name is Karen Lidster, and I am staff to Representative John Coghill. This resolution is attempting to oppose the attempts that Congress is making to divide or split the insurance regulations between the states and the federal government. The optional federal charter has been introduced in both chambers of the U.S. Congress. To avoid such a move by Congress to enact federal regulations of insurance, the legislature passed HB 439 unanimously back in May of 2006. This bill added Alaska to the Interstate Insurance Product Regulation Compact, and comprised of 30 states to serve as a single point of filing for specified insurance products, and it established uniform national standards for those products. All of you certainly know Representative Coghill and his stand in states' rights and sovereignty, and the state of Alaska has would, if this was passed, there would be the choice of whether or not an insurance provider would fall under the optional federal charter or state regulations, and it would just, we believe that it would be best to keep the insurance providers under our state regulations. And so we are asking for your support of this resolution. I have asked Jeffrey Trout, who is with the Division of Insurance, to speak to the very technical aspects of insurance, and appreciate your consideration of this resolution.
Actually, we've been joined by somebody else that might care to comment before Jeffrey. Representative Coghill, do you have anything you wish to add?
I just came to see how good my staff is doing about this one. And so I'm really open to listen to the questions that come up.
So you're refusing the opportunity to
support your own bill?
Support your own bill, yeah. Any questions for Karen before we get to Jeffrey? Representative Ledoux, followed by Representative Newman, by Representative Gardner.
On page 2, line 21, it says, whereas the federal insurance regulatory system would cause a loss of jobs. Could you explain that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I will have to ask our expert from...
Mine.
from insurance to deal with that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Newman, is this for Jeffrey or is this for Karen?
I think Karen can handle this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 2, lines 27 and 28, where it says, further resolved that the Alaska State Legislature opposes any law that would establish a federal insurance regulatory system. So could I put in the words there, the state of Alaska opposes more bigger, bloated federal government? Would that be about the same thing?
I think the sponsor would probably be, through the chair, I'm Representative Newman. You can make whatever amendments you so choose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the sponsor statement, well, I guess everywhere, it talks about an optional federal charter has been introduced. Can you explain how the phrase optional is in there? Would it be optional for states to participate or nay?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, it would be optional. And so within the state, you may have some insurance agents that have chosen to fall under the federal regulation, and some would perhaps choose not to, and so they would be under the state guidelines, regulations.
Thank you. So in follow-up, that would be at the option of the individual agent, not the state.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
We're getting
I believe that's companies and not agencies. That's insurance companies, man. Jeffrey, you want to get up here and get beat up?
Sure.
Thanks, Karen.
I'm going to have to remember to get Kevlar.
Remember, we're not talking about real estate today.
Okay. Yes, sir. Morning. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeffrey Trout. I'm Deputy Director of the Division of Insurance, and I'm here to express the division's strong support for HJR 24. For over 100 years, state regulation has served consumers in this country and served it well. There's an expertise and an expertise that that's been developed within state insurance departments nationwide. And part of the reason I think for this is that it's closer to the people. State regulation just is closer to the people than federal regulation is. And having personally worked both for the state and federal government, I can tell you this based on personal experience that the federal government can be detached from. Even the best-hearted people can be detached from what's kind of going on the ground in other states. They know because we live here. We know what's going on. In FY06, for example, we closed 330 consumer complaints, which resulted in a return of over $500,000 to consumers who were wrongfully denied claims. We also are able to keep a closer eye on solvency issues, I think, than the federal government would be able to. That's because we know the markets better. The people we regulate and the people we serve, they're our neighbors. They go to the softball games that our kids play in. We're able to update, I think, faster than the federal government can our laws. I mean, if you've noticed that almost every year we've had a bill come up to do some clarification, to make some revisions based on market conditions or based on the need for uniformity, which I'll address in just a moment. But in general, state government works faster than the federal government does, and we work with our And having said that, I should say we work with our state government counterparts nationwide to improve uniformity, to make it easier, to streamline licensing so that you can go to, so that someone who's out of state can come here and compete, and our people can compete in other markets as well. The process is admittedly messy, and it never works as fast as we would like it to. But still, there's no guarantee that federal regulation would be any quicker, or that a one-size-all approach, which the federal government tends to take, would be more efficient for Alaskans. And one of the concerns that we would have in an optional federal charter is that there's no federal regulations. The bill contemplates regulations being drafted, but we don't know what they would have. But I would be concerned that a lot of the things that we in Alaska have decided that we're going to have as part of our market would not be there. For example, mandatory benefits, things like that, things that must be covered, wouldn't necessarily be covered under an optional federal charter. The other thing is the abundant amount of case law, insurance case law in each state that people rely on and that agents already know. That would be changed. It would have to develop federal common law. So we'd have the federal courts, you'd have the Second Circuit making precedent that applies to us here in Alaska. In addition here, local regulation also allows investigations, prosecutions, financial and market exams based on our knowledge of the market, which, it's imperfect as we can be, I think would probably be better than what the federal government could produce, and certainly more knowledgeable about local conditions than the federal government. The other suggestion I'd like to make to you is that in our attempts to bring uniformity and across state lines, which we strongly believe in, we want to make it as easy as possible for companies to do business here. We have a disproportionately strong voice, and mainly, many of the uniformity efforts are through the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and we have a disproportionately strong voice. We're one of 53 jurisdictions, and not 50 states, but 53 jurisdictions, if you include Guam and all that. We would be insignificant in a federal regulatory scheme. I believe it was $2.8 billion of premium in a $5 trillion market. So out of every thousand, if my math's right, out of every $5,000, about 56, every $1,000 worth of premium, about 56 cents of it comes from Alaska. So it would be difficult for me to see that we'd have the kind of voice that we have now under the optional federal charter. An additional concern I'd have is taxation revenues. Under the bill that's currently before Congress, there would be, the state would be able to tax premiums. I'd be concerned about that continuing. At least the first thing I would think of if I were an insurance company lawyers is, hey, we don't have to pay this. This is interstate commerce. Or to try and change that aspect of the regulation in the future. The optional federal charter is an idea that's been around for a while, hasn't passed yet. Substantial players in the industry support it, because they believe it would be less, that it's very complex to follow 50 state jurisdictions and all that. I understand that it is difficult, and it is difficult to keep up with that and get people licensed, etc. But if you've read the policies, these insurance companies are good at dealing with complexity. Simplicity, I don't think, is necessarily a good enough argument. And we would be dealing with the creation of another large federal bureaucracy. I realize again that it's difficult, but all borders present some barrier to trade in some way or another, whether it's a national border or a state border. But ultimately, I think we in Alaska have done a good job in making the border as unobtrusive as possible, while still, or as less a burden into business, while still maintaining the consumer protections that Alaskans expect from us. We work hard. We work hard to make sure that the Alaskan border is, between us and the other states, is as insignificant as possible. And having said that, that pretty much concludes my reasons, and I'm open to get pressed.
Representative Gardner, followed by Representative Ledoux.
I say two questions. First one is on page two, starting at line 18, whereas the federal insurance regulatory system would put at risk the taxes, fees, and other vital necessary state revenue needed to effectively regulate the insurance market to support residual market programs. So what are residual market programs? And these taxes and fees are paid by the insurance companies to the state to cover regulatory needs. And if insurance companies, if we didn't have regulatory activities here in the state, the insurance companies didn't need to pay those costs and fees that support them, would that result in decreased premiums for consumers?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Gardner, we have taxes and fees. We charge a fee for licensees and applications and things like that, which is meant to cover the cost of regulating them. But we also collect premium taxes. We tax the premiums people are paying.
As do all states.
Right. Yes. As do all states, and it's a source of revenue, just like a sales tax or anything like that. In the event you had an optional federal charter adopted, you would see a lot of, it'd be like banks. You have banks that are regulated by federal government and state regulated banks. I believe there's two state regulated banks. Every other bank you go to is a national bank. And I do believe that that a lot of companies would go for a federal under the optional federal charter because A, it's going to be simpler for the company. They're going to have to follow rules that just sort of, given the nature of federal regulation, making the companies are going to have a lot bigger impact on the federal government. This is the large companies. We're going to have a lot bigger impact on the federal government's making regulations as larger than they do in the state. There'd be less impact from consumers. It's just sort of based on my observation and of how the federal government has worked. So I would be concerned ultimately that a lot of the consumer protections that we have based in our laws could erode under an optional federal charter, and there would be nothing we could do. We have the problem with ERISA regulations, or when people call and give us, when they do a consumer complaint on an ERISA matter or on the state health insurance program, we have to tell them, sorry, we have no jurisdiction over this. We can't do anything for you. Well, here's the guy in the federal government you can contact. So there's a concern about a lot of that eroding.
Thank you. Through the chair, would there be any reduction in premium costs to consumers?
The chair, Representative Gardner, it depends on who you talk to. I personally don't think so. I've read the argument that the federal government can regulate cheaper than the states can. I rather doubt it, but I mean, I can't give you any empirical data. I doubt that insurance premiums would go down. I mean, the trend is up, and I don't see, you know, that changing because the federal government now regulates them any more than the cost of your automobile has gone down because the federal government regulates. That's maybe a little unfair analogy, but. Mm-hmm. But the cost of a lot of things, federal government regulation, I can't think of any instance where it's resulted in something being cheaper.
Okay. I have one more question. Okay. So it's clear that you support this legislation, or rather that you oppose the optional federal element. Do you see any potential benefit to having the feds take over the chartering?
I think there's a benefit for insurance companies, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. It would be a lot easier to deal with one jurisdiction.
Any benefit to Alaskans?
any benefits to Alaskans?
I don't think it would. Improve it would create less confusion on the part of consumers or on the part of part of agents. We've done a whole lot to make sure that it's easy for a company that's located somewhere else to come to Alaska and compete. And I think that's where you're going to find the chief benefit is increased competition. I don't know that an optional federal charter would result in more businesses or more companies coming to do business here. I mean, we are a small, you know, we're a small market, and the cost of regulation is pretty small compared, whether it's federal or state, is pretty small compared to just the money that can be made in larger markets, I don't think the optional federal charter would attract companies that might not otherwise come here.
Thank you,
Representative Ledoux.
I've got actually two questions. First of all, page 2, line 21. Why would a federal insurance regulatory system cause a loss of jobs? I mean, is that just because there wouldn't be state workers doing?
I think that would be part of it, but I think you'd see migration. You'd see lost jobs in Alaska. A lot of our people would either leave or go work for the feds.
We have companies that are domiciled here that might move outside and consolidate with their insurance companies.
That's conceivable as well, Mr. Chairman. And I forgot to say through the chair, Representative Ledoux. Sorry. There would be the element of it'd be easier to buy up a company, and you don't need people who become a little more expendable and they're gone. I jokingly said lots of jobs mine, but there would be. I think you would see in a lot of larger places like California and New York, you would probably see a lot of companies moving to that. Just like you'd see a lot of companies, end up in banks, as national banks instead of state chartered banks, and so I think you'd see a migration of a lot of those people to the federal government, to the D.C. area from Albany or Sacramento, but in Alaska, I think you would see you could see some maybe consolidation, a lot of the independent people being bought up and gone. Those kinds of things.
Second question?
And I'm not really sure that you could answer this question, but I'm going to ask it to you anyway. I would have thought that on these sorts of insurance issues that the agents and the brokers and the insurance companies would have been on the same page, but it doesn't appear that the companies and the agencies and brokers are on the same page with respect to this resolution. Do you know why?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I honestly don't. Different companies have different feelings about it. I believe State Farm sent a letter saying that it was supportive, that it was opposed to the bill. I think a lot of the independent agents would be in favor of it because they would feel threatened by a federalization of the industry. But there's a whole lot of considerations that companies have that are sort of internal to themselves that make them support or oppose an optional federal charter. Some of it may be just, you know, they have to deal with the.
I think I can take a shot at that one. I am one of the people that signed the NCOIL letter. I represent Alaska for this particular organization, National Council of Insurance Legislators. And I think what you would see is the big companies, the real big companies, would have an advantage under federal regulation. The smaller companies, the mid-sized companies, the agents and the brokers wouldn't. And I think that's why you see the split.
Thank you.
And I don't think I have to declare a conflict of interest because NCOIL is made up of labor and commerce chairs from around the country. So that testimony was in that wearing that hat, not my current hat. But I'll get off my soapbox on that. But I'll get back on it. We are supportive of this, and it is one of our highest priorities this year. But does that help?
It does. Thank you.
Any other questions for Jeffrey? Well, thanks again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have nobody signed up online or any of the LIOs to testify. And I see John Grummet here who in the room, so we'll come up to the table, John. I think we had you down just as, didn't say whether or not you wanted to, but you've got our undivided attention. Please state your name and affiliation, both your affiliations for the record.
Hi, my name is John Grummet. I'm the president of the Alaska Independent Agents and Brokers, and I also am vice president of Shattuck and Grummet just down the street. And I am an independent.
And that was established in 1919?
1898,
that's
yes.
Right.
Okay. And I am an agent. And we, as agents in our association, go with the consumer protection. I mean, that's what we're after. We represent the clients. We represent Joe Public in purchasing their insurance. Okay. Did everyone get this packet I passed out? Okay. If you would indulge me, I'd just like to read through the first letter and state our case. The Alaska Independent Agents and Brokers would like to submit the following comments in support of HJR 24. AIIAB is one of the oldest and largest producer trade associations in Alaska. We represent over 360 independent business owners, agents, brokers, and employees in the state of Alaska who sell and service the personal and business insurance needs of consumers. Independent agents and brokers provide a professional service to their clients regarding their property, casualty, life, health, employee benefit plans, and retirement plans. State-based consumer protections must remain intact. Alaska, in particular, has a difficult insurance environment at best. Alaska struggles to find adequate markets, and the needs of Alaskan consumers vary greatly from consumers of other states. State regulators understand the nuances of their own marketplace much better and can respond to market demands much quicker than a federal regulator. It's imperative that the consumer protections that the state regulation of insurance provides remains intact. The creation of an optional federal charter, we believe, would decrease the current consumer protections. Support for targeted federal legislation. AIIAB does support streamlining and modernizing the state system of insurance regulation through targeted and limited federal legislation, which would act as tools to help establish reciprocity or uniformity to create interstate consistency. This would allow for a system that responds quicker to industry demands, yet maintains the state-based consumer safeguards, which are critical. Examples of limited federal legislation that have worked include surplus lines and reinsurance reform, agent and company licensing reform. Federal regulation is not the answer. As stated previously, we do not agree that there is a need for specific targeted regulation to improve efficiencies and uniformity in insurance regulation. It's our belief that an optional federal charter is not the answer and would increase confusion for both consumers and the agents and brokers that service consumers. AIIAB has many reasons for opposing federal oversight in the insurance industry, and here are just a couple. Local insurance regulation works best for consumers, and the state system ensures a level of responsiveness to consumers that could not be matched at the federal level. Agents and brokers would be required to become experts on both the state and federal regulations which apply to insurance. It would create a confusing environment whereby independent agents may have to deal with multiple insurance companies that could choose to follow state regulation or federal legislation. This would force agents who choose to be state licensed to know and understand a federal regulatory system they may prefer not to deal with, but have no choice. Small insurance companies could be at a competitive disadvantage against larger companies that could afford to switch between the two systems. The smaller companies could get stuck in an unfavorable regulatory environment they can't afford to get out of. By eliminating or drastically limiting regulatory review of policy language for the small commercial and personal lines markets, federal regulation would leave consumers unprotected. Federal regulation would have a negative impact on revenue Alaska collects through the loss of licensing fees and threaten the state premium tax revenue, critical funding relied upon by the states for various purposes. Lastly here, federal regulatory oversight is not the answer and would only provide confusion to our consumers, brokers, and agents. We urge you to support HGR 24. Just a couple other comments. I know that the premium tax, which is collected, is in the top five for the state of Alaska, and it was just over $46 million last year. I think it's slated to go to, or budgeted for $47 million this year, and that goes right into the general fund. That's not as far as I remember, it's not earmarked for the insurance division.
I believe it's the number three, isn't it?
Number two.
Yeah. Oh, number two.
That's something I should point out. My apologies. The second largest source of revenue in the state.
Pales compared to oil, but yeah, we're number two.
It's above studded tires, though.
The following organizations have adopted similar resolutions or have come out strongly against OFC: the National Governors Association, the National Conference of Insurance Legislators, the National Conference of State Legislatures, the Council of State Governments, National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Resolutions like this are being adopted in an increasing number of states, but most are under consideration now. Texas adopted one last year. States as diverse as Ohio, West Virginia, New Hampshire, and Rhode Island are considering them now. And that's really all I had at this point. We urge you to support it, and we thank Representative Coghill for putting this forward for us.
I'd like the record to reflect we were joined by Representative Rammer some time ago, but I failed to mention it.
About an hour ago.
Representative Gatto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you ever help individuals who have issues with insurance companies? As an insurance company sells a policy to me,
mm-hmm.
and I say, I'm making a claim, and they're saying denied. And I say, well, who do I go to?
We do.
You?
We would represent them and go back and ask for a reconsideration of the claim and try and find out the story mm-hmm. and explain that to the client themselves. If we felt that the client was getting misrepresented, we would have them file, go to the division and file an unfair claims practices report.
John would refer to the consumer people at the Division of Insurance. They've got a whole department that handle follow up on
that's who I'd like to talk to.
I think Jeffrey can give you the and if we didn't have state regulation, you might just have to call a 1-800 number.
And the reason I'm asking, if I can continue, is you don't want to see the feds get involved. You probably don't want to see the state get overbearing either. But if you get situations that occur where some individuals look like they're being badly treated by insurance companies for the most, for the best reason I can think of is because they can, then do you say, well, listen, I think this is unreasonable and I need to maybe become involved? Would you do that?
Would we do that? Yeah. But our involvement would be limited. I mean, it's hard for me to answer how I'd behave in that because I've never experienced it. I mean, we've never had in our office a situation where we felt a client was just not being recognized and was getting a shaft on a particular policy.
But how about if it isn't a client? What if it's just an individual who says, there is a major company, and no matter what I do, I am just thrown out with the bathwater. It doesn't matter, and it's been going on, let's just say, not 08, not 07, not 06, but even 05. Is that a long time?
That's a long time.
That'd be Jeffrey's department.
We would refer that person to the Division of Insurance.
Have a few private sector problems.
And we can't get involved with other people that are not our clients, typically, because companies only represent one agent or broker at a time.
But that would go right behind you then, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Okay. And we have done that. We have referred people to the division before.
Representative Ledoux.
So who do you represent? Do you represent the person buying the insurance, or do you represent the company that is selling the insurance?
We represent the person buying the insurance. It's my job to get the best coverage at the best price for that person that comes in my front door. And competition ensures that I do that, or somebody else down the street's going to pick up that client.
So do you represent, or do you sell all sorts of insurance? Everybody's? I mean, is there just one line you sell, or do you sell insurance from a whole bunch of companies?
We sell insurance from a whole bunch of companies, from life insurance to property, casualty, commercial, boat.
Auto.
Building, homeowners. Business, you name it. We try and get into it.
But what I mean is, so let's say we're talking about automobile insurance and somebody comes in for automobile insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you represent more than one company selling automobile, or do you sell? Okay, thanks.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Always a pleasure to see you.
Good to see you, sir, Representative.
Well, with that, I think I'll close out the public testimony and bring it back to the committee. Is there any need for me to get Representative Ramirez, or do I hear a motion to?
Just doing numbers. I'd do a motion.
I'll entertain a motion to move this resolution out.
HB.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I'll do it, and I'd like to make just a little statement about that, but I'll move House Joint Resolution number 24, and I believe we're just version A with any fiscal notes and individual recommendations. And I'd like to say I came in here without any opinion about it, this meeting, but it just seems to me that if insurance companies, large and small, have the option to choose from between two different regulatory environments, the choice that they make, I don't have any reason to think would be to the benefit of the consumers. So that's why I'm going to go ahead and support this bill moving on.
I sense a certain amount of skepticism there, but seeing no opposition, we'll move the resolution out. And with that, we will adjourn at 4:12.